This is the Convict Australia podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Hi everyone, I would just like to start by acknowledging the Dharawal speaking people, who are the traditional custodians of this land, and I pay my respects to elders both past, present and future. Today I'll be talking about James Roos with one of his descendants, Janice Roos Huntington. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you.
So you've done extensive research over the years on James Roos and have even written a book. And can you tell us a bit about James? He's one of the, well, better known convicts in Australia.
Yes, he was termed the humble adventurer by Captain Watkin Tench, who interviewed him, took quite interesting convicts. And he's sort of a quiet achiever. When they sent the first fleet out, they didn't much account for what type of people they need, and they weren't very prepared to set up a colony. But James Roos had been a husbandman, as he referred to himself, which is a landowner of a lower degree, not a squire, and in Cornwall. So that's how he probably attracted attention to his skills. And he probably did work on the government farm at first. And he claims on his own headstone that he sowed the forest grain in a Cornish phonetic way.
So could you tell us a bit about his early life, like before he was convicted? Where was he living?
Yes, he was born in a little village called Lewiton, which is just outside Launceston or Launceston. And he was one of four children, and he was a farmer. He grew up a farmer or a husbandman. He married at the age of 19. He married a 33-year-old woman.
Really?
Really, yes. Which is interesting because his own mother had died when he was 7. So whether he was looking for a mother figure or what. And they had, his wife Susanna had two children. Little girl died in infancy, and then a son. Now the son lived and had his own line in Cornwall, his own line of Roos's. So there are Roos's over there and with the name, and Roos's over here without the name. He, for some reason, he turned to burglary. Maybe she was an expensive woman to keep. But he broke into a house and stole a watch and goods to the value of 10 shillings, a watch worth £5, and got caught.
Did he do it with anybody else?
We don't know. There's no mention of it. There's no mention of it anywhere. But he was convicted alone, and he was sentenced. In those days, he was sentenced to death. There were crimes called with the benefit of clergy, and those certain crimes, death was the automatic sentence. The judges did have the authority to commute it to 7 or 14 years, and his was commuted to 7 years, first in Africa, when they thought it was a bit inhospitable for the fair English folk, and then sentenced to Australia.
Yeah, it's funny that they commuted a death sentence to 7 years. You'd think they'd commute it to life.
Yeah.
But he's gotten shortest sentences.
Yeah. Well, they didn't really want them, the convicts, anymore. The prisons were getting full and they were trying to get rid of them, so out of the country.
So where did he go as soon as he was sentenced? Where did they take him?
Well, he ended up on the Dunkirk, which he told Watkin Tench. But the Dunkirk wasn't commissioned till, I think, 1786, and James Roos' sentence was 1790. So he was somewhere in that time. He could have been on another hulk. He could have been in prison. But that's where he ended his time. And he was 4.5 years on a hulk or in prison before he was sent to Australia.
That must have been frustrating to think you're nearing the end of your sentence and then you're going to be sent to the other side of the world, so far away from your family and children.
Yeah.
Yeah. So which ship was he on the first fleet?
The Scarborough.
Right, okay. And what happened when he arrived? Do you know if he was assigned work straight away or?
Well, it's not, there's nothing much recorded, but it assume that he did go to the government farm to work with Philip's entourage, and maybe he got the opportunity to apply for a grant for himself. But it said that he applied and was knocked back because the paperwork hadn't been received from England.
And that was his sentence, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that was for everyone on the first fleet. None of their records were sent out. So Governor Philip was in this really awkward position. All these convicts were coming to him saying, my sentence has expired, and he had no proof to do. He was writing to England saying, what do I do? Please send the paperwork. And I believe it took more than 2 years for that paperwork to come out.
Well, of course the colony was starving. I think it was pretty desperate to get something happening. And so we don't know whether James Roos approached him, or I've got a theory, and this is only a theory because I don't believe in putting anything down that might be taken as a truth. But it's interesting that James Roos was born in Lewitton, just outside Launceston, and Philip Gidley King, who also came on the Scarborough, was born in Launceston.
Oh.
They were born about a couple of years apart, 1 or 2 years apart. They were virtually the same age, down the road, neighbours. And you can't tell me that on the Scarborough, they both were, two Cornish lads wouldn't have got together and had a bit of a chat.
And
he may have said to Philip, well, there's a bloke who is a farmer in Cornwall. It may have been that way. Maybe it wasn't that Roos jumped up and said, I want a land grant.
I believe that there were so few convicts or anyone that had any kind of farming experience.
That's right, yes.
So he would have
well selected at all.
Yeah. So Governor Philip granted him land. How much land did he get, do you know?
He gave him to work on 1.5 acres and built him a brick hut.
Wow.
And gave him some basic stock and a couple of convicts to help him with the land, and said that he wanted him to prove in what time a person could become self-sufficient off the land. And if he did that, he would be granted the 30 acres. And he did receive the 30 acres, which was Experiment Farm. But a testimony to his stubbornness or his pride is that at one stage in the experiment, people thought he was starving and offered extra stores, and he just refused to take them until his wife was pregnant, and then he took extra stores for her and the baby.
But he was
A new wife, yes. He married Elizabeth Perry, who came out on the second fleet.
So she was a convict also?
Yes. And they had a very, very long and interesting marriage. And she was very supportive, strong woman, country girl from England, and very competent. And when he was not able to be around after floods and things and had to go to sea to support the family, she ran the show. So she, like Elizabeth MacArthur, a couple of strong women there, and they end up neighbours.
When he said he was self-sufficient, did he include his family, or was it just him off the stores?
No, him, the whole family off the stores.
And did it get to the point where he was supplying the stores with food as well, or is it just his family?
No, they became to supply food stores. He succeeded very well with the land. And part of the reason, and this is very interesting, Watkin Tench, again, who took interest in the convicts, visited him often and interviewed him. And James Roos described to Watkin Tench how he prepared the land. Of course, he said the government farm, it was just turned over and, you know, not very well prepared. But he burnt ash and trees and turned it back into the land, and he planted turnips and then turned them into land. He was virtually making compost.
All right. You've mentioned a few things, but do you know what he was growing primarily there?
Maize and wheat, several things. Yeah, I couldn't exactly name them all at the moment. But, yeah, the basic staples of life.
And were there any floods?
Oh, there's the poor man. Not in Parramatta, not really floods in Parramatta, but when he sold his property to Surgeon John Harris, he moved in 1793, he moved to around Windsor Way, the new settlement up there, and with a few other convicts, and the land was very fertile, but it was fertile because they got so much flooding. And the apparently the Aboriginals warned them, because they'd been there historically long enough to know that there were regular floods. So these poor settlers, they've settled, oh, there's a nice bit of water here, and this will be lovely. And horrendous floods, houses destroyed, devastating floods.
So where was his first property?
Harris Park, which is right. Now Parramatta, yeah.
And then he decided to sell up. Do we know why he decided?
Well, it's interesting. It's recorded that he wanted to go home. And it could be many reasons why he didn't go home. Maybe with he and Elizabeth, they'd both been convicts. How would they be treated back there? Did they have a better life here? James Roos' wife had Chen remarried, but she'd had another child while he was on the ships or out here. So maybe he knew about that. I don't know how much communication there was between, decided not to. But the interesting thing is he sold his property to Surgeon John Harris at £40, while other properties around were selling for much more than that. And I don't know. I wonder why he sold it for so little. Was he under pressure to sell?
Yeah, I guess we'll never know.
So many things we'll never know.
Yeah. I believe he got robbed at one stage too.
Yes, he did. Yes, the convict becomes the victim. And he was robbed by people he knew. Even Reverend Robert Cartwright was involved, and he was a reverend. And he found these clothes on other people. So they got into trouble. Of him for change.
And what was the sentence they got? I believe it was pretty harsh.
I think there's a bit of flogging going on.
I was reading that. I don't know if this is right, but it got 200 lashes and 6 months with the iron collar.
That's painful.
So how many children did he have?
Well, he had the two in England, and the one survived. And in Australia, he had Rebecca, who only survived for a couple of days, and she's buried in St. John's, Parramatta. And Elizabeth, Mary, Susanna, I'm descended from Susanna. Then there were two children, Anne and James. James was born after Rebecca, and he seems to have disappeared, but I will find him. Anne and William appear in the family surreptitiously and a bit mysteriously, and they change their name to Kiss later in life. And we've just, the descendants have conducted a DNA project and has proven that Anne and William were in fact the children of Mary, Elizabeth Roos, but not James Roos.
Oh, okay.
So while he was out to sea trying to keep the whole thing together, he's obviously had a bit of a fling with James Kiss, who was a fellow convict. But this speaks of his compassion as well. He took them in and raised them with the family, with the Roos family. And, in fact, so close were they that when Elizabeth Roos died in 1836, James Kiss and James Roos went and got baptised in the Catholic Church together at the same time. That's quite unusual.
Did James ever return to a life of crime?
No, he didn't. And again, to his credit, in the 1820s or so, someone approached him to do something shonky, to hide wheat under James Roos's bed and then sell it on behalf of the other person, a dodgy deal, and he refused to do it.
What about Elizabeth? Did she ever get into trouble again?
No. They became model citizens, really. In fact, James Roos moved up in the echelons of society, and he was a witness to Andrew Thompson's will. Andrew Thompson was quite famous on the Hawkesbury. And Elizabeth was received an early pardon. They're quite well respected.
And they were successful farmers out in the Hawkesbury?
Other than the floods and the famine. James Roos ended up working as an overseer to Richard Brooks. So he had an actual job at the end. Okay. And Elizabeth was with him. And he had a bit of plot of land and a horse. So he ended up quite comfortable in his life. I don't think he was a good wheeler dealer from the land department, because he lost a few things to mortgage and lost. But I would say a very successful farmer, perhaps not so successful in money management, a very compassionate person, the way he treated his extended family and stayed with Elizabeth and looked after everybody. He took in when husband left it, that was the one that became a Kiss. He took in her son to live with them, and someone else took in a couple of other children. And they really had a good family situation.
And is that where they stayed for the rest of their lives?
They scattered. Elizabeth married an Armfield and they went down Berrima way. There are a lot of Armfields down in Berrima. Susanna Mine, she, bit of a flighty lady, she left her husband and took up with someone who was working on their property and married him and went to Yass and had another baby with someone else in the meantime. And they scattered. We don't know ever what happened to Anne Roos Kiss. Whatever, she married several times, is practically untraceable. And I will find James Roos. He was apprenticed to Cable and Underwood in 1801, so we know he was alive then. He was mentioned in a document in 1815, so somebody assumed he was alive in 1815, but that's another little 20 years to find him.
But yeah, it's actually easier to trace when they're convicts, isn't it?
It is, yes.
If they live happily ever after, you don't hear anything.
Oh, no, that's right. They need to have done something worthy of mentioning in the newspaper or court.
Yeah, that's right. Is it true that he made his own headstone?
Yes, it is believed, and it's 19. I'd say it's absolutely true, because he. It's in the first person. It's written.
Oh, right.
My mother reared me tenderly. With me, she took much pains, and all spelt phonetically. And when I arrived in this colony, I sold the first grain. Now, someone has come in and filled in the dates for him. And I've read that it was that person was a man called Thomas Shea. And when I had to have the headstone removed because of vandalism in the church, often this Thomas Shea used to sign his name at the bottom of the headstones that he created. And when the headstone came out, there was no signature on it, Thomas Shea. But that's possibly because he didn't carve the headstone. He filled in the dates. Now, that's why it was essential to have it removed and placed safely in the Campbelltown Ayres Historical Society Museum, where it's safe, it can be seen forever, because that would be that is irreplaceable.
Yeah, definitely. So many convicts didn't even have headstones because they just couldn't afford them.
No, well, if you do it yourself.
Yeah. Wow. And, so is it true also that he claims to have been the first person, well, first European to set foot on Australian soil from the First Fleet?
That is true that he claimed that. And it's quite hysterical when you get a bunch of First Fleeters together and several people claim it in the same venue. But he did appear in a court case in 1830-something or other, and he claimed and swore on the Bible that because he said he carried Captain Hunter on shore, save his feet getting wet, that he made that claim in court. And the following day, someone else wrote something that he carried Colonel Johnston. But neither were ever refuted in the time. And no one else has ever given any evidence like that, anything in writing, that their claimers had set first foot on New Holland. So we don't know. But the evidence is that he claimed it and nobody refuted it.
Right. So you are so lucky to have a convict that there's so much documentation for. Like he's, as you mentioned, he's in what contentious journals, he's in other journals. And now he's remembered in so many ways. James Roos Drive, I believe there's an agricultural school named after him. Yeah,
there are parks named after a suburb of Roos.
Yeah, that's right. That must be really lovely for you and your family. I believe you've written a book about him some time ago. Why did you create this book? What inspired you for him specifically out of everyone in your family tree?
Because when I was going to school, my grandmother used to say, she called him James Rouse, because she's close to the Cornish side and she still had that country sort of accent. And she had a little plaque. I used to take it to school and hold up. But I didn't actually know how, and she didn't know how either. So I set about finding how, and that took me 5 years because of there's an Irish in there and the variations of the names, but I finally got it together. And then I wasn't satisfied, so then I went back to see what happened in England before, but nothing was known about his life in England other than that he was a convict. But, yeah, and I haven't stopped. I probably never will stop. I just keep going, branching out and branching out.
A labour of love.
Yeah. But one little thing often bugs me, Arthur Phillip said, there can be some more intelligent but no one more industrious. And I think about that sometimes, because intelligence can't be equated with education. You could be a very intelligent person who's never been to school and lived in under a rock, but it doesn't mean that you don't have the intelligence and you don't have the education. But
that's
I think he had the street smarts to do what he did.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking with us. It's been really interesting.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks so much. Thanks for
and
your time.
Where can people get your book? Can I leave a link in the show notes where people can contact you for a copy?
Yes, I can give you. You can give them my email address.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for your patience.
All right. Bye.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Convict Australia podcast. If you'd like to show your appreciation and get more involved, there are a number of ways you can. The first is by signing up to Convict Australia on Patreon, and you will get some perks like the Convict Australia newsletter. Secondly, leave a review and tell your friends and family. This really does make a huge difference. And lastly, join the Facebook and Instagram group Convict Australia. All the links I've mentioned will be in the show notes. Thank you again. Till next time.